This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and I am pleased to welcome today Jamie Peck. Jamie is the co-author with Nick Theodore of Fast Policy, Experimental Statecraft at the Thresholds of Neoliberalism, which was published in 2015 by the University of Minnesota Press. Jamie, welcome.
Nice to be here.
So before we talk about Fast Policy, before we talk about this book, I wonder if I could ask you to say just a little bit about your own intellectual biography, the kinds of questions that interest and animate you, and perhaps how it is that you arrived at this particular project.
Okay. Well, I think this the project that Nick and I worked on for the last few years that culminated in the book had gestated for a long time. Both of us have been working on issues of welfare reform and labor market policy, really from the 80s onwards. We didn't start to collaborate until the mid-90s, but at the point we did begin to collaborate, what really struck us were the extremely strong resonances and echoes between policy reforms on either side of the Atlantic. Prior to 2000, I was based at Manchester University in the UK. I was doing quite a bit of empirical work in the United States. I spent a full year there in the year running up to the Clinton welfare reform of 1996. And after Tony Blair was elected in the UK, it was really quite striking how so many of the policy routines, narratives, and so on that had been in circulation in U.S. welfare reform debates were being retasked for the purposes of welfare reform in the U.K. Mm-hmm. And so from the mid-90s, when Nick and I started to collaborate, we were having this conversation about the connections between policy reforms in nominally separate jurisdictions and the complex nature of what it meant to transfer a policy idea or framework from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And both of us were rather dissatisfied with the conventional literature on policy transfer, which struck us as rather literal in its concerns with, if you like, revealed mimicry and strong connection in terms of the naming of programs and so on, that for us it seemed to be skirting over the surface of a much deeper and rather more political and sociological set of connections between systems of policy and regulation and politics that were, of course, had their own dynamics, but in a sense were beginning to get into dialogue with one another. So we'd actually tried to get a project moving in the late 1990s, frankly, to no avail. We actually found that it was rather difficult to find the resources to work on these kind of comparative questions, given that a great deal of academic funding is also siloed around national systems and the NSF in the US and ESRC in the UK and so on. So we'd kind of had this as a back burner project for a while, and we were delighted when eventually we could put some of these ideas that we'd had to work about after 2008, when the Ford Foundation showed some interest in these questions as well. So they'd been percolating for a long time, and we were very keen to dig into them when we got the opportunity.
And what is it that you think made the Ford Foundation interested in the kinds of questions you are asking, whereas others had been perhaps less interested, at least up until that point?
I think there are a number of things about Ford's interest. I mean, they were particularly interested in how it was possible to move progressive policies from one place to another. They, like us, had been witnessing the fact that more conservative or neoliberal policies, often many of which are quite stylized, sometimes technocratically framed and so on, seem to hop from place to place with ease. In contrast, the policies of the left and progressive policies and so on seemed to be rather more difficult to move, or they needed more different channels to move them around. I think this is a long-standing concern for parts of the Ford Foundation, at least, is how to move genuinely good ideas from one place to another. Now they'd seen how bad or rather thin ideas were apparently moving very quickly from one place to another, and they wanted us to get into this question of how progressive policies would move. And the other notable thing about the Ford Foundation is that they were willing to take a bit of a gamble, I think, on this project. They, in contrast to funding agencies like the NSF or the research councils in England, Ford were less concerned that we could nail down every aspect of a methodology and a strategy in advance, and more willing for us to be a bit more experimental and open-ended, which this phenomena seemed to call for. It would be hard for us to have imagined in advance exactly how we would pursue these the policies that we followed in the book. We wanted the remit to be able to be adaptive and move around from one case to another, not to be too rigid in advance about our plans. And Ford, we were delighted to see, were willing to give us that freedom to kind of explore these questions in a bit more of an open-ended way.
So why don't we use that as a way to talk about the subject of the book itself? So there are two policies that serve as the foci for your analysis. Can you talk a little bit about what they are and how you wound up choosing them?
Yeah. Okay. At one level, this is a potentially long story, but we had been thinking for a while, as I mentioned earlier, about conspicuously rapidly moving policies, policies that seem to be finding lots of adherence and reference points around the world. So we, in a sense, we were thinking about the kinds of policies that might enable us to explore these questions of complex connectivity between policy experiments in different places. The two we chose were participatory budgeting, strongly associated with the city of Porto Alegre in Brazil and with the Brazilian Workers' Party and the Lula administration, which had moved from its site of origin, if you like, in Brazil to literally thousands of administrations around the world in the period since the 1990s. That was one of our policies, if you like. That we chose that as it seemed to us to be one of the favoured policies of progressives. Mm-hmm. It was almost it had been popularized and circulated by the global justice movement, left-leaning and centre-left administrations all over the world and in Europe seem to be especially interested in borrowing these ideas of participatory democracy and using them to reanimate local democracy at the municipal scale in a range of contexts. So PB, or participatory budgeting, seemed to us to satisfy that criteria of being an especially dynamic policy that was traveling from the global south to the north and opened up a potential field for us to investigate. The other policy that we decided to study was called conditional cash transfers. This is a reform to social policy which conditions the payments to welfare recipients or to low-income families on certain behaviours, that the kids must be in school, they must be up to date with their shots in the local clinic and so on. And it was a kind of paternalistic policy that seemed to be at the forefront of social policy reform and likewise had travelled very quickly from a place of origin in probably Mexico, but Brazil also claims to have invented this policy, to, again, many jurisdictions around the world. Mm-hmm. And what interested us about these two policies is that the conditional cash transfers seem to be circulating with the approval of the World Bank and the multilateral agencies. In a sense, they were somewhat conservative policies, but a little bit difficult to classify since they also featured goals of women's empowerment and they were somewhat redistributive to very poor families. Mm-hmm. They weren't the kind of typical, if you will, off-the-shelf neoliberal reform. Likewise, PB seemed to be actively critical of neoliberal policymaking and challenging those policy positions of neoliberal reformers and developing grassroots alternatives to market-oriented policy and so on. Mm-hmm. So the attraction of these two policies to us was that they both were potentially unpredictable in their origins and travels. A preemptive story didn't seem to easily fit them. They weren't easily coded as Washington consensus or anti-Washington consensus policies, but were somewhat kind of complex and ambivalent. Mm-hmm. And so they provided an opportunity for us, I think, to literally to follow the policy as we would describe our method and if you like, see where it took us rather than begin with an examination where we had a fairly clear idea what the conclusion would already be. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do this kind of open-ended exploration, and they provided a chance for us to do that.
So why don't we, let's talk a little bit about the participatory budgeting. One of the things that I think is particularly useful and interesting about the book is, as you referenced earlier, it really does push against what can sometimes be a fairly simplistic model of policy transfer in a lot of the literature, and suggest that I don't know if you would phrase this quite this strongly, but in every instance, any act of policy transfer is going to be contingent. It is going to be dependent upon a whole host of things, including the means by which that policy transfer occurs and the local space that it winds up being pulled into, right? It's moving into an already existing policy space. So there's presumably no rational reason to expect that it's going to wind up looking the same in all of those places. One of the things that I found particularly interesting, especially about participatory budgeting, is that it wound up starting as a policy that is often sort of traced to the First World Social Forum, but it too, like conditional cash transfers, winds up being its own neoliberal kind of policy in some jurisdictions, and it too winds up being celebrated by the World Bank. Can you talk a little bit about what the heck happened and how we make sense of that?
Yeah, I think what happened with both of the policies we were following is that their journeys were we didn't fully anticipate what we would later encounter. I mean, our fieldwork for the book took place over a period of about 4 or 5 years.
In 15 countries, correct?
In 15 countries, and we did a lot of we far exceeded our original Ford Foundation grant, but we were able to do a lot of opportunistic work wherever we happened to be in the world, which tells a story itself in some respects, in that if we were giving a talk in South Africa or Berlin, we could almost certainly find traces of participatory budgeting and possibly also conditional cash transfers in the somewhere in the jurisdiction. So we ended up following these policies fairly exhaustively, but not completely, of course, because the traces were all over the place. But the point that you mention about the way in which participatory budgeting was, in a sense, partly co-opted by the prevailing powers that be, you know, starting off as a radical project of democratization and what's sometimes called deep democracy in Brazil, to some of its weaker and PB light forms, which in certain European jurisdictions look like the opportunity for local residents to vote on the scale and direction of austerity measures rather than to vote on priorities for social investment, as really that was their origin in Brazil. So they've kind of been, some of these participatory budgeting projects have been kind of twisted almost to become the opposite of their original intent. They were used and approved by the World Bank as measures that would, in some respects, discipline local government, to restrain spending in certain kinds of ways in local government and so on. And you might consider that story of co-optation to be a rather familiar one, the extent to which a policy gets pulled into the kind of vortex of dominant power relations. Perhaps we shouldn't have been hugely surprised that participatory budgeting on some of its travels became compromised, even though it retained its kind of radical edge in many other contexts. Ironically, to a certain extent in the United States, the participatory budgeting network there is a very interesting kind of progressive grouping that sees lots of opportunities to use the policy progressively. So there's this kind of complex, two-faced, double-faceted nature to participatory budgeting then, that we found it partly co-opted and partly retaining some of its original promise. But perhaps more surprising to us was the fact that conditional cash transfers, the arc of their transformation possibly bent in a rather different direction, possibly even away from the dominant interests, although we wouldn't want to overstate that. What we saw with the rollout of conditional cash transfer projects was, to a certain extent, they became more heterodox over time, as opposed to more orthodox. If PB was pulled in an orthodox direction towards prevailing political economic interests, conditional cash transfers at least offer the possibility of turning towards progressive policy implementation. They started to blend in some cases and in some countries with the interest in basic or citizens' income. They actually provided a kind of demonstration case against some of the prejudices of conservative reformers. They showed, for instance, that welfare dependency arguments about how poor families would likely misspend their payments if they weren't required to spend the money in the right way on education and healthcare, for instance. There was very little evidence of those welfare dependency effects, such that the CCT experiment started to be a sort of demonstration case that you could, in fact, do a cash transfer to poor families. It has a with a positive effect without ruining the national budget. These could be delivered relatively efficiently and could actually move the Gini coefficient in countries like Brazil. So then seem to offer the possibility at least of moving in a progressive direction.
I mean, there's a fascinating irony in the way that you tell that story, and that you give an awful lot of credit to sort of the ways in which randomized control trials were central to encouraging local governments to adopt conditional cash transfer experiments, and they were often understood to be experiments. But in sort of the, if you look at that trajectory, it is that particular devotion to empirical evaluation that winds up undercutting the sort of the neoliberal rationale for these very paternalistic kinds of programs. And in some instances, is it too much to say that it actually starts to open up space for maybe unconditional cash transfers that don't require that you engage in particular kinds of behaviors?
Mm-hmm. Precisely so. And I think at least that it begs that question. By virtue of the kinds of questions that are asked in randomized controlled trial experiments. It sort of begs the question of, well, what happens if we relax or even remove some of the conditions on families? What kind of effects do we see there? So I think partly the randomized trials beg that question, even if they were predominantly funded in what we would characterize as a conservative direction. Mm-hmm. And they reflect the fact that the World Bank itself has acquired new sources of influence that we would argue as a model builder. And it uses randomized trials to a certain extent to refine and scientize its models of preferred policy reform. So there's a big apparatus that's been built around that process, which nevertheless leaves, I think, open some of these interesting questions about unconditional programs. Plus, once we started to get into the complexities and the weeds of policy operations, especially in Brazil with their big Bolsa Família program, it became clear that at the level of implementation, conditions weren't necessarily being enforced. Mm-hmm. Consistently, strongly. There was a certain degree of looking the other way by policymakers at the local level when it came to conditions. So Bolsa Família became a kind of a sort of natural experiment in having weaker conditions. And I precisely opened up this space potentially for, well, okay, what would happen if there were unconditional transfers mm-hmm. to low-income families? And it's interesting that the organizations like Oxfam and some of the Scandinavian countries have supported some small-scale experiments in unconditional transfers. The results of which have been quite encouraging and interesting, even though they're massively outscaled by the randomized trials of conditional programs. But in a sense, that opening is there. It's an opening that was is there partly because of implementation questions in countries like Brazil and parts of Africa, where CCTs tend also to be introduced with less clear-cut forms of conditionality monitoring.
And is part of that simply because the actual enforcement of clear conditions is it's incredibly expensive? I mean, New York City discovered this a hard way, right? The cost of the experiment in the Bloomberg administration, 40%, 46%, something like that, right? Wildly expensive to run that program. Is that part of what pushes against the strict enforcement of conditions?
Mm-hmm. The conditions require, to a certain extent, a strong state structure or at least some sort of parallel state structure at the local level. You have to have a delivery system and monitoring system and so on. Where those things are fragile or uneven, there'll be unevenness and fragility in the delivery of the program and perhaps also the monitoring of conditions. Mm-hmm. So the World Bank's favored CCT experiment is in Mexico, where there was a well-founded sort of technocratic framework built around the CCT program in Mexico. And if you like, that's the kind of preferred model. But as it got into the world in other places, in some cases, places where there's more frailty in the capabilities of the local state at the local level, like in parts of Brazil, or ironically, in New York City under Bloomberg, where the plan to kind of overburden the project with so many conditions, and it was really dragged down by the excessiveness of all of the conditions that were imposed on the experiment in New York. It kind of failed because of the weight of those conditions. So in a sense, these projects become rather more difficult to operate when they're out in the wild in a kind of unevenly developed world with different kind of government capacities and interests.
Interesting in that, arguably the New York program achieved some demonstrable, albeit modest, successes, but because I think the ambition was so great that it was going to be this giant transformative thing right off the bat, was deemed a failure. I'm also curious about sort of that juxtaposed with the fact that the Mexican program survived and has changed, to be sure, but has survived any number of different kinds of administrations. I guess I'm wondering if you could sort of talk a little bit about what do you think about why has the program in Mexico endured, whereas the one in New York City was deemed a failed experiment and has largely disappeared? Are there lessons, maybe more generalizable lessons from that?
Yeah, well, we suspect there might be. The Mexican program was notable for the fact that its randomized trial methodology was co-developed with the program itself, if you like. It was born wrapped in an evaluation strategy, which would produce some fairly clear indications of how effective the policy was quite quickly. And the plan from, as articulated by one of the architects of the policy, Santiago Levy, from the start, was to make sure that an intervention could be constructed that was, in a sense, above political manipulation. And what it effectively did, I think, the positive first results of the Oportunidades, Progressor Oportunidades program in Mexico, the fact that the first results were so encouraging meant that the political class felt it was unable to kind of mess with the program or wind it up. I mean, there's been some renaming and tweaking of it, but not fundamental reform. And in a sense, its promotion as a sort of world-class intervention bulletproofed the program from the interests of successive administrations. And over the course of the last decade or decade and a half, the program has really become a sort of fixture in the social policy landscape in Mexico. It will be a bold politician, I think, that attempted to roll back the program or to radically change it without the confidence that the reforms would be significantly improve the program.
So you think that at least a non-trivial portion of that pushback would be international as well as domestic in Mexico?
Yeah, I think so. The fact that some of the earliest results of the Mexican experiment were published in English in Washington, D.C., reveals the fact that the program was partly developed with a view to an external audience, as well as an internal constituency. It was designed to be a world-class intervention with a world-class evaluation strategy attached to it, which would make it beyond meddling and to create a really strong narrative around the program's success, which, even though it may have been tarnished slightly, I think has been retained. And likewise, the multilateral institutions like the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank themselves wanted a crisply formulated, implemented, and evaluated demonstration project that would prove the case for this new generation of social policies, which I think it certainly has. And I think that has that's opened the door to implementation in something like 50 other countries since the Mexican pioneering model of the later 1990s. So it's been a remarkably rapid change in a policy field, welfare and social policy, that many observers would have said was rather kind of jaded, devoid of new ideas, in the kind of post-welfare reform climate in the United States. There was this kind of sense that the Clinton reforms of 96 had worked, in inverted commas, or just the oxygen and energy been sucked out of the project of welfare reform. There seemed to, even though what the welfare reform in the US begat was replaced poverty on welfare with poverty in contingent low-grade employment. I mean, could hardly be regarded as a success from a objective standpoint. But the reform process was just completely burnt out, exhausted, it seemed. And so this is why Bloomberg, I think, potentially shrewdly, although it didn't really work out so effectively, decided that he would kind of try and change the narrative by borrowing from Mexico and doing something that attracted a great deal of attention from policymakers in the domestic sphere of policymaking. And so, again, he wouldn't have done that, I don't think, if the reputation of the Mexican model wasn't already quite well established. He was able to say this is already a world's best practice, and we're going to see if we can develop a version of this in New York City.
So this is a little bit outside the purview of this book, so you can feel free to say you're not ready to sort of think out loud about this on the spot. But, I mean, it seems to be interesting that your previous work, we think about workfare states, which you've talked about sort of obliquely, that a lot of the scholarship on welfare reforms in the 90s in a number of different places has focused its attention on labor market effects and the ways in which sort of cutting back access to cash reliefs and pushing women with children and others out into the low-wage labor market has put downward pressure on wages, which has worked to the benefit of the people who you would expect to benefit from lower wages. To what extent are people thinking about the labor market effects of conditional cash transfer programs? Is that playing out in the politics as you've seen it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of the big longer-term questions about these programs. I mean, the presumption, the World Bank rationale for them is very much as a supply-side intervention, that if we can improve the human capital of the rising generation of young people, this is an intervention focused on the young, on the children in poor families, more so than their parents. The focus is on improving the human capital of the rising generation by ensuring they're healthy and well-educated and complete their periods of schooling. The orthodox reading of that is that that should improve their employability, improve the quality of the workforce, and they are become more employable. I think the limitations of that analysis are that it takes little or no account of the structure of labor market opportunities on the demand side, if you will. What jobs are being produced, where, under what circumstances, and so on. And I mean, the evidence that there is about the effects of conditional cash transfers tends to prove this point that supply doesn't create its own demand in the labor market, that yes, children are completing schooling and so on, but there are not necessarily big increases in their success in the labor market because they are often entering weak labor markets that are not providing many opportunities for career development or good quality employment. And so, again, that might be another example of the way in which the actual experience of conditional cash transfers in the real world raises some critical questions about the limitations of orthodox thinking about employability. It really begs the question about what's being done to improve the quality of employment and the quality of jobs and the locations of jobs and their availability for to low-income families and job seekers from those families. I think it, in the bigger picture of workfare reforms since the 1990s, this will be quite an important chapter in that. It suggests that we've the whole kind of policy debate is moving on in several ways, and I think these employability questions will become more and more pressing as these policies run for several years and, again, beg that question about how far they really improve job chances.
So why don't we turn our attention back to participatory budgeting for a little bit, if you don't mind. I mean, I'm curious about this. To grossly oversimplify a very complicated story, policies that we could crudely describe as sort of two different trajectories, one from sort of almost at least paternalist, if not neoliberal, ideology moving into something that is different. And then something that began as, I mean, my first hearing of it is I was living in New York City at the time and sort of was around during the introduction of participatory budgeting processes in the New York City Council. And it really was being talked about by activists and advocates on the ground who had been doing organizing and work in low-income communities for decades, trying to fundamentally alter the space for them to participate, really were talking about this as this is the thing that creates this sort of emancipatory politics by giving people direct experience in it, and it is going to change the way that we organize American democracy. And I heard sort of people who are not usually hyperbolic talking about the program in those terms, and yet in so many of the places where you trace it, that is not how it's playing out. So, I mean, can you talk a little bit about how we explain that? And again, what are the lessons for the people who might like for this to be emancipatory? Is there something they can do, or is this so conditioned by already existing circumstances and power relations that there's a limited space to make it more progressive?
I think with the example of participatory budgeting, we see there a policy model, if you like, that was born in the context of the struggle for democracy in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And it gained its foothold and its momentum in the context of an historic period of democratic opening, where there are major problems with existing state structures and limited democratic channels, and really provided an opportunity for this kind of grassroots, deep form of democracy that would mobilize local communities, engage them with the issues of social investment and so on in their very own communities. So that if that were its origins, we find it's somewhat ironic, you might say, that you could find it in being used in the kind of mature stage democracies of the advanced capitalist nations, where in a sense it stands as a kind of critique of the lack of responsiveness of a formerly democratic system. And just as you say, a kind of an opening for different kinds of political interventions at the local scale that might start to change the conversation as well as engage local residents in these questions of investment in parts of Harlem and so on. And I think those that have mobilized around participatory budgeting in the United States in particular see this as a transitional step, certainly not the end of the story, but as a way to kind of open up these conversations about how poorly existing services and so forth are serving many low-income communities. And I think as a kind of demonstration effect of that point, some of them have been quite effective. And so I think our sense was that the groups that have organized around PB in North America have done so in a very knowing and strategic way. There's no naivety here at all. And in fact, many of them are extremely well connected themselves into transnational networks of to Brazil and elsewhere. They don't know full well the story of how participatory budgeting has been used in other places and so on. And so you have here an example, I think, of progressive networking with its own international connections, channeling into the very local scale interventions in Chicago, New York, and elsewhere where there are PB beachheads have been established. Mm-hmm. But very much as a transitional accomplishment. I mean, one thing that struck us was that it's quite often for PB projects to be supported by reforming politicians, often local alders or locally elected councillors, who are not necessarily at the centre of power in their local administration. They may be in the freshly elected and in a kind of reformist frame of mind. You know, there's some questions about how PB would be used on a kind of mature, extended basis in some of those situations, whether it is really a long-term intervention or, you know, a way to kind of open up this political space. And I think most of the activists see it in the latter as a way of opening up a political space and then see what they can, what next steps are open to them. Mm-hmm. I don't think they necessarily see this as a way to completely reorganize municipal government in the United States. It tends to be quite modest, you know, maybe $1 million reallocated in a community in Chicago around, you know, improvements to playgrounds or that sort of thing. So these are quite small interventions, but at least put these questions on the table. I think that's what the activists have been mobilizing around.
So we are nearing the end of our time. So let me ask a question that I probably should have started with. So when you're talking about these two cases as instances of fast policy, as policies that move around the globe in historically unusual speed, are we going to be seeing more and more of that? Is that simply a product of changes in technology and living in a modern interconnected era?
I think that is partly the case. I mean, I think the fact that it's very easy now to learn about what the world's best practice is in this or that policy field. You know, they say that no policymaker is an island anymore. The policymaking is now takes place in what we call a relativized context, where policymakers themselves have their own cosmopolitan connections. They have often a lot of information about other reforms in other jurisdictions. Again, none of the we didn't encounter any naivety amongst policymakers here. They're knowing actors here. They know that they're not going to be in the business of replication, but they also see the opportunities to move things along rapidly in a certain direction if there are policies that arrive with a narrative of success attached to them, perhaps a track record of positive evaluations and so on. So I think our sense is that this is a significant change, which is going to be with us in the long term. It's been co-produced historically with the era of neoliberalism, of course, and so there's a discussion about the extent to which this is a creature of neoliberal governance, or it will still be with us even if we manage to shake off neoliberalism. We suspect it will stay with us. It's independent to some degree of the neoliberal moment, although as a late 20th century, early 21st century phenomenon, neoliberalization has only it's kind of been co-produced, I suppose, with the deepening and thickening of fast policy circuits. Our sense is that this is a significant transformation in the way that policymaking occurs, that it will increasingly occur in this mutually referential, interconnected fashion. And therefore, there'll be an amplified role for models, both orthodox and conservative and radical and alternative. Policymaking may increasingly take place in the shadow of models in a positive or negative way. Mm-hmm. It'll certainly take place with a much wider consciousness about the landscape of reform transnationally. And so that means that I think the policymaking process itself is a different animal to what it was in the 1970s or 80s.
That sounds like at least to my ears anyway, a rather sort of hopeful vision of where we're going, knowing that the outcomes could be all over the map, at least better opportunities for more complicated and more sophisticated and more informed policymaking.
Yeah. And plus, I think both Nick Theodore and I have done a lot of work on the nature of the neoliberal moment and what that means and what kind of hegemony has been constructed around neoliberal rule. That can be a rather pessimistic, if not fatalistic, endeavor. We actually wanted to do something very different in this book. I mean, we're familiar with those stories about relentless neoliberalization, privatization, and so on. Very familiar with them. We wanted to do something a bit different. And I think what we came away with was the conclusion that things happen at the level of what we call policy fields. You know, the daily struggles over the nature of programs, the nature of reforms, the nature of evaluations even, that make a real difference, that the future isn't preordained. We don't know how this story will end. Even policies which have got an enormous amount of weight behind them, ideologically, politically, in resource terms and so on, even those policies can take unusual turns. And so for us, this kind of opens up a different kind of agenda for working on the policy process in this rather more institutionally embedded, sociologically connected kind of way to think through the ways in which strategically policies may surge off in a number of directions, and it may be possible to turn corners in surprising directions with many of these policy fields. Certainly it's not preordained and already fixed for the future. So there are, I think, progressive and encouraging openings here, and reason to think that the battles over the direction of policy, in be it in municipal development or social policy or economic policy, those battles are worth persisting with, because the future isn't known, the outcomes of those struggles, and they are still highly consequential.
So in our last couple of minutes, we've been talking with Jamie Peck, who is the co-author with Nick Theodore of Fast Policy, Experimental Statecraft at the Thresholds of Neoliberalism. So are you continuing to work on this project, moving on to something new? Can you talk a little bit about the questions that sort of are sitting forefront in your mind at the moment, beyond the ones you've just articulated?
We're working in this general area, yes, certainly. What's happened, I think, over the last few years is that a sort of interdisciplinary project has emerged around what many are calling policy mobilities, as a rather different approach to these questions of the connectivity and mobility of policies from those traditionally highlighted by the policy transfer literature. And this new approach to policy mobilities brings together geographers and urban planners like Nick and I, anthropologists, sociologists, some political scientists. It really is a sort of interdisciplinary project, which I think is opening up this terrain of not just fast-moving policies, but complex forms of connection across reform projects and transformation projects, which really, I think, opens up a quite different and exciting agenda for those of us who've been interested in policy questions for a long time. Often working in this area, it feels like you're in a rather parochial field where you deal with a bunch of institutions and acronyms that people on the other side of the world aren't necessarily engaged with. This policy mobilities project itself is a sort of cosmopolitan project. It's a project of exploring connections across sometimes long distances and across jurisdictions. And at least on the basis of our explorations in this book, I mean, we found that policymakers themselves are just as interested in these kinds of questions as academic researchers. I mean, I think there is a whole new program of work to be constructed around this these questions, and it's quite an exciting time, I think, for those of us working in this field.
Terrific. I'm Stephen Pimper. I'm the host of the Policy Channel at New Books Network, and we've been speaking with Jamie Peck, co-author with Nick Theodore of Fast Policy, Experimental Statecraft at the Thresholds of Neoliberalism. And as I hope this conversation has revealed, it's a terrific book and really does open up some new ways of thinking of how these kinds of things are going to play out in what is a world in constant motion, and perhaps in motion faster than it has been in the past. Jamie, thank you so very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Stephen. It was a pleasure.